talking about transparency and openness, we've certainly got it after the RHI inquiry, haven't we, into the Renewable Heat Incentive Scheme, RHI. Today is the final day of the inquiry into it. It began hearing additional evidence earlier this week and is taking closing remarks from barristers for several key participants. They include civil servants who were responsible for the scheme and the DUP. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, has been across the story from day one. Morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So this is, as you were telling us yesterday, this is the barristers coming in and representing some of the key participants.
That's right. This is really counsel for individuals who are likely to face the greatest criticism, the people who were most heavily involved in this scheme. Each one of them now gets the chance to fairly briefly set out what they say the evidence means, to try to draw out the pieces of evidence from the 111 days of hearings, which they say are the most significant, and to try to make any sort of mitigating arguments for their clients, to try to explain why they did what they did, if they know that they are definitely going to be facing criticism on a particular point, to try to, if you like, soften that or put it into some sort of context. So that's really where we're at this stage, really the final stage before Sir Patrick goes and finalises his report.
And let's start then with some of what Sir Patrick Coughlan has been saying. He's the head of the inquiry. He began by asking about responsibility when it comes to Arlene Foster. Let's have a listen.
If I turn now for a moment to Miss Foster, she has a saying that she is accountable and not responsible. I for myself, am not entirely clear as to what that may mean. But let's take one or two matters. You've told us she did not pick up the additional material that Ms. O'Hagan had put in to her September email. I take it she is responsible for that.
Without having direct recollection of the evidence on that particular point, I would imagine that yes, she would accept that she did not read that email closely enough.
You referred to record keeping, and am I right in saying that she had no reason to believe that records, and let's look at the two vital meetings in June of 2011-2012. I take it that when you say she has no reason to believe that records weren't kept, does it flow from that that she saw Ms. Hepper making a record at the time?
I think her recollection of both meetings is relatively... She has said that she can't recall those meetings in any detail.
Yes. So
from that perspective, I can't, and again, without looking specifically at what she said in relation to minute taking of those specific meetings, I can't commit her, but I do believe that given her recollection was not complete, she would not be saying that notes and minutes were specifically taken of those meetings.
I understand if she is saying, in normal circumstances, I was aware a record should be taken at all times, but I can't recollect whether one was taken at these two meetings. Is that what she's saying through you?
I think she's saying that the usual practice throughout all of her experience in dealing with officials was that officials had a notebook in front of them and took notes. Her understanding was that subsequently that would be converted into some sort of formal record.
But she has no specific record
specific
of this meeting. Because obviously Ms. Hepper says a record wasn't taken. It's as simple as that. So far as her relationship with Mr. Crawford goes, she has said that she assumed Mr. Crawford would read all of the more detailed reports. He has said that wasn't his job. Is she responsible for communication with her SPAD as to what actually should have been the practice?
I think that's a matter that the inquiry really needs to make a finding on, Mr. Chairman. It's not something that I can speculate upon at this remove from the bar.
Well, then another question I would have about Mr. Crawford is he says that when he was communicating with Mr. Cairns about raising the hours to 3,000 and how that would be helpful to Moy Park in the poultry industry, that wasn't something he had talked about to Miss Foster.
That's correct.
And when you say the views of a SPAD should be respected from experience, does that mean that a SPAD acting for the finance minister can negotiate about financial matters without going back to her? Especially with a major commercial entity in the community.
That certainly is not the message that I was intending to convey, Mr. Chairman.
Sam?
Well, I think that exchange which you heard at the start of that clip about Arlene Foster having said that she was accountable but not responsible, that's now one of the standout quotes from her evidence to the inquiry. I think at this late stage of the process, hearing what Sir Patrick said about that yesterday, the sorts of questions that he was asking in relation to that is probably not something that bodes well for Arlene Foster, because if she has not managed to really adequately explain to the chairman what is, I think it's fair to say, one of the central planks of her defence in all of this, at this stage where he is about to write his report, I think it's probably fair to say that at least at this point, Sir Patrick Coughlan is not entirely convinced by that. And if you recall what Arlene Foster said when she was before the inquiry, was that she was democratically accountable, she was accountable to the Assembly, she would come before the Assembly and answer questions about what had gone wrong with RHI, but she was saying that it wouldn't be fair to hold her responsible for what had happened in the same way as she said it would not be fair to hold her responsible for one of her civil servants having in some way acted criminally or done something which was very, very serious. She'd say that she was accountable for that as a minister, but she wasn't responsible for that. That is a distinction which I think it's fair to say at this stage Sir Patrick doesn't seem to be entirely convinced by.
Let's move on to Jonathan Bell. He says that if it wasn't for, well, his barrister says that if it wasn't for Mr. Bell, the RHI inquiry would not be taking place. And he says the way Mr. Bell's been treated by his former colleagues has been uncalled for. Let's have a listen.
A lot of the headlines in this case, again, are about Mr. Bell personally. And I know, members of the panel, that that isn't really part of your remit. But it's something that he has had to face in the media. An allegation that he had tried to break somebody's finger, which turned out to be completely untrue. The personal animosity became a story, and it's not really the real story, which will, in my respectful submission, emerge from this. What is true is that there was a desire to blame Mr. Bell for the scheme and for the delay in the scheme. That criticism came only and has only ever come from two quarters, from the DUP and from SPADs, and nobody else has sought to blame Mr. Bell for any delay in the scheme. And as the evidence and the documents have borne out, he did everything that he possibly could to close his scheme, but was hampered by the degree of control. The degree of control from SPADs is demonstrated, we say, by, for instance, the recall of the approval, the 19th of January document, that they were able to do this, and all that, the only involvement of the minister was an email to say that it had been done. His consent or approval wasn't sought. The delay in the suspension and closure of the scheme was because of legal advice, consultation process that did or did not have to be gone through. But he made the decision to close the scheme. It was an unpopular one politically, but he did that. The cleansing of the record, expunging of evidence, whatever one wants to call it, the reference to the office of First and Deputy First Minister was removed. And no adequate explanation has been given for that. One explanation was from Timothy Johnson that it was so that Mr. Bell could be given all of the credit. Now, whatever it was, it certainly wasn't to give Mr. Bell credit, and indeed one might think that something absolutely to the contrary was already in play at this stage.
My goodness, Sam, it's a world that most of the public don't know exists. What goes on behind the scenes here?
That's right, and that was really one of the central arguments of Ronan Lavery QC, who you heard speaking there on Mr. Bell's behalf, where he was really trying to put it to the inquiry that prior to Jonathan Bell breaking ranks with the DUP in his televised interview with you, really all that the DUP had said publicly about Mr. Bell was really highlighting his best qualities, saying that he was somebody that the public should support, saying that he was somebody who was capable of doing his job. Now he was saying that the DUP were really trying to undermine Mr. Bell's character, trying to say that they had serious concerns about him all along. And there was a very interesting element of Mr. Lavery's written evidence, which he didn't speak about yesterday, but it's been submitted to the inquiry, where he highlights that Arlene Foster, who of course now really denounces Mr. Bell, says that she had serious concerns about him. He says that on at least two occasions she either spoke or campaigned on behalf of Mr. Bell when he was the candidate in South Belfast. This was just a few months before RHI ran out of control. So she was telling the public, this is somebody you should endorse as your Member of Parliament. This is the most suited person for that task. Now Mr. Lavery is highlighting, look at what she says now. So the implication, I suppose, of what he's saying is that the DUP have not been entirely straight with the public in public in terms of what they're saying, as opposed to what they now say were their private feelings at some of these points.
Dr. Keith McLean asks about the treatment of the whistleblower, Mrs. O'Hagan. Let's have a listen.
I just had one point of clarification. When you were addressing the issues about Mrs. O'Hagan, you said at the end that she deserved an apology for what had happened in the treatment of her complaints and for the treatment in the media later.
Yes.
Can I just check in that language that where the responsibility for that lay with people from the DUP,
well,
that the apology has been given on behalf of those people to Mrs. O'Hagan, in particular for the treatment in the public?
The inquiry will be aware that there has been evidence given about how it came to be that Miss O'Hagan's name was published, despite her having expressly said to someone within the department that she did not want her name to be put into the public domain. The DUP clearly did have a role in that, albeit they weren't at the time fully aware of Miss O'Hagan's position. But for their role, certainly an apology. This is the apology. And I believe Mrs. Foster has already apologised in her oral evidence for that. Miss O'Hagan should not have been treated in the way that she was.
I remember also, Sam, Nigel Dodds running around waving a sheet referring to Miss O'Hagan as the so-called whistleblower. There was nothing so-called about her. She was a whistleblower, and she was legitimate.
That's right, and that is something which, of course, now the DUP fully accept and are they've expressed a degree of remorse or regret as to what happened there. Nigel Dodds certainly put out a pretty aggressive statement at that point. I think the line from the DUP is really to blame the civil service on that and to say that they had handled the communication with Ms. O'Hagan. And I think what we really see in that incident is this blurring of the lines within Stormont between what civil servants do and what politicians do. So the whistleblower thought that she was speaking to a civil service department and that really there was no political involvement in this. What was actually happening was that it was a civil servant who was acting. That information was then being passed to the minister, and the civil service may well say that was entirely proper because they were acting under his direction and control. But that then ends up in this almost attack statement, if you like, from the DUP as a political party.
Depending on what Sir Patrick says, Sam, are political careers on the line here? Arlene Foster, for example, now she's apologised on behalf of her party, and then when she was pushed in the following days after the party conference, she said yes, it was also an apology from her. Is that enough, or depending on what Sir Patrick says, could that bring Arlene Foster down or not?
I think that if there are really serious criticisms of Arlene Foster in Sir Patrick's report, it's going to be very difficult for Arlene Foster to survive. She has survived for a very long time now since this all became a public scandal. She has, of course, been greatly diminished in terms of her authority from the position that she held at the point where this all became public, where really she was a very popular leader of unionism. She is something which people now almost forget, but she was really at the height of her powers. That is not who she is now, but she's still there. And a bit like Theresa May, she is very difficult to dislodge for some of those people within the DUP who want to dislodge her. But I think that this moment of the publication of Sir Patrick's final report, that is a moment of acute peril for her, and she will be under great pressure, I think, within the party and outside the party, and let's not forget from Sinn Féin, who will have to go back into government with her if she is still the DUP leader, and if they want to go back into Stormont. So there are several fronts on which she will face significant pressure if indeed she faces significant criticism in Sir Patrick's final report.
Are you going to miss it, Sam? Have you met Sir Patrick?
My family certainly aren't going to miss it. They're eagerly looking forward to the point when I'm freed from this. I haven't met Sir Patrick, but I've seen an awful lot of him from following this.
And when can we expect his report?
Well, that is entirely up in the ether at this point. But from something which he said on Wednesday, there was an allusion there that it might come faster than some of us expected. He said that he will not be routinely writing to those who are going to face criticism. That is one of the elements which can seriously delay a public inquiry report. It very significantly delayed the Iraq report by Sir John Chilcot, where Tony Blair really fought some of what was going to be said in that. By the inquiry chairman. So that's not going to happen here. That means that this could be a much swifter process, but I think it would still be a surprise if we see this much before Easter of next year.
Sam McBride from the newsletter. Thank you very much indeed.